But, gentlemen, if I want to admit, I've always hated to hear anybody get up to the podium and say I met our speaker a few minutes ago, but he was flying until a few minutes ago, so I didn't have a chance to talk with him much, but I have heard his tape, and I know we're looking for a good talk tonight. About the only thing I know to say about him is that he's an old broke-down attorney from Dallas, Texas. They've got more attorneys out there than they got white rats. You know, a lot of times people start to say something, they start off saying, they say so-and-so is fixing to get married. I never know who they is. So when he gets up here and to start talking, he's going to tell you my name is Jerry, Jay, and that's about all he knows, and the rest of it is they say. So y'all help me work with Jerry up to talk to you tonight.
Hi, I'm Jerry Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and by reason of its principles since January the 1st of 1973. It's good to be back in Georgia. It's been a long time. 5 years ago right here, I guess, somewhere in town here. I can't remember whether we were in this room or not, but I think we were. I enjoyed that weekend very much and was very pleased to get a call to come back and visit with you again. I'm a lot of things. You've already heard the worst. I saw several people leave when they found out I was an attorney. Now I'll tell those of you who don't like lawyers what I tell everybody that doesn't like lawyers. I hope the first time you need one, you don't use them. I'm the adult spouse of an Al-Anon. There she is right there. This is my wife, Billy, who came with me. She's here. She's really here to see me crash and burn. I'm sitting on this perch up here, you notice. I don't know, about 30 days ago, my back got out of whack. And this is the first time I've been out to try to talk or do anything much since then. And she, about 2 days ago, I took a cold or a flu or something and didn't look like I could talk. And she tried to tell me that somebody might be telling me that I might not be supposed to go to Georgia. But I just viewed it as another challenge and went right on. And so she's tagging along, you know. Al-Anons have unusual attitudes. I came in from seeing the doctor the other day and I told her, I said, Billy, this back injury may substantially impact our lives. She said, what do you mean? And I said, well, I don't know how to tell you this, but the doctor says that it could cut down on 50% of my sexual activity. She said, what are you going to do? Stop thinking about it or talking about it? They're hard. I'll tell you, they're hard. I hope we have a good weekend here. I'm going to have a good weekend with people who have experienced the kind of problems that I've experienced in my life and who have solved them with a common solution. We won't all have the same problems, but we will have solved them, if they're solved, with a common solution. And it's nice to be with people like that. That always does something for me. I always come away with a lift when I've been to a weekend like this. I see a lot of things happen in Alcoholics Anonymous in the last 15 years. I think back on when I first came in and how good it's been for me. I didn't hear as much then about treatment centers and a lot of the things that we hear today that as I did, and I hear more today than I did then. But one of the things I never hear anyone talk about on the radio or television is that they're going to cure your alcoholism by giving you a spiritual awakening. Hardly anybody talks about that. When you see people in your newspapers write up something about Alcoholics Anonymous, they seldom say, these drunks are recovering because they have had a spiritual awakening. Why is that? Well, because most of the world is living out there in the tangible. And spiritual things are intangible. Things you can't see. Things that are there, that are real, but that you can't see. And the fact is, they are just as real. Our book says God's just as much a fact as we are. But it's difficult to convey this. People think you're going to get way out there in the ozone when you begin to talk about things spiritual. But our book tries to disarm that. Our book says that if what we think or feel means anything at all, it means that anyone, no matter what his race, color, or creed, can form a meaningful relationship with his Creator if he has the honesty and the willingness to try. So it's a natural thing that we're going to try to do, to wake up, to have this spiritual awakening. The principles that we talk about are not new. Alcoholics Anonymous didn't invent them. But Alcoholics Anonymous put them in a package. Those first 100 drunks put them in a package and a procedure that drunks can follow. And it's a program of action. Very basically, you have to take the action. It won't be the action you want to take. It will not be the action that you used to take or like to take. But you have to take the action. And it doesn't matter whether you believe it or not, whether you like it or not. If you take the action, the result will follow. That's how you know it's the truth. That's how you know it's real. You know it's real from other things, too. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1973, January of 73. I didn't like you very much. There was a bunch of phony happiness going on here. There was some drawings and, you know, hokey, crappy little stuff. Like some guy would stand up and say his name and everybody would say, "Hi, Jerry." Oh, I was embarrassed to be in the same room with adults acting like that. Thought they were going to teach me the grip next to some kind of high school fraternity or something, you know. I just hugging and patting around on each other and looking happy and, you know, it wasn't real. But it was. In a little while, I began to realize that I was dealing with the real thing. These people were real. What they lived was what they are. I encountered our greatest principle, the principle that binds us all together. And that's the principle of experience. What man has done, man can do. When I was a kid, I was raised out in West Texas, a little old farm 10 miles from the big town of Bovina, Texas. And I we'd go to town once a week, whether we needed to or not, to shop and just go to town and drink a Coke or something. And I watched the town kids. The town kids all had bicycles. And I watched them ride the bicycles, and I wanted a bicycle. And I asked my dad if I could have a bicycle, and worked on him for a few weeks, and finally he agreed, "I'm going to buy you a bicycle." So we ordered one from Sears and Roebuck, and it came in a crate, and we put it together. And Dad was through with it then. He got it put together, and he pumped up the tires and gave it to me. And I walked out there and got on it. I'm going to ride it. It never occurred to me that a bicycle would be hard to ride. Town kids didn't seem to have any problems driving. I'd never tried to ride one. And I swung up on the seat of that thing and went right off the other side and just busted my kid. And my mother was a helpful soul, and she said, "Let me help you." And I said, "All right." So she would hold the bicycle up, and I would get on it, and then she'd trot along beside me a little ways and give me a little shove, and I'd fall over. We have a lot of stickers and goat heads out in West Texas, and I was getting pretty well peppered with that, those things, you know. I've been on the ground a lot more than anywhere else. Tried it 2 days running, and I came to a great truth. You know how you just know something is the truth? I knew the truth. The truth was that I had been sold a defective bicycle. Well, I had. I had been sold a bicycle that nobody could ride. And I told my mother about it. I said, nobody can ride that damn bicycle. I ain't going to ride it anymore. I'm not going to try to ride it. She said, Jerry Jones, I haven't ridden a bicycle but maybe once or twice in my life. And that was years and years and years ago. But I could ride that bicycle. And I said, you could not. So she got on some slacks and went out in the yard and got on the bicycle. Started to ride off, fell over, busted her can. I was kind of sorry to see it, but I'd warned her. And then she got up and she tried it again. And this time, she didn't ride it. 25 yards. And it wobbled a lot and didn't go in a very straight line, but she rode that damn bicycle. And she laid it down on the ground and she said, that's all the mess around this bicycle I'm going to do. And she went to the house. An hour later, I was riding that bicycle. But what I encountered in Alcoholics Anonymous was some bike riders. I ran across some folks who began to teach me how you have a spiritual awakening. How you change your life so that this thing of alcohol and alcoholism is something you can live with. Now, to be real honest, I didn't read the steps and analyze the steps the way I have by now when I first started. I didn't look at that 12th step where it said, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I didn't pick up on that for a while. But I began to watch these people. And I began to listen to what they had to say. And I began to do things the way they did them and the way they told me to do. And the result came along. First thing you got to do to have an awakening is to recognize that there's a problem in your life. Lots of drunks don't know there's a problem. If there's a problem, it's not my problem. It's somebody else's problem. It's not my fault. It's somebody else's fault. We have the most magnificent minds the world's ever seen. We can see black as white just as easy as anything. You know, we just lie. God, we can lie to ourselves, to everybody else, and really believe it. Really buy into it. We rationalize and justify, and we hide from the truth better than any group of people I ever, except maybe Al-Anons. Al-Anons may be almost as bad as we are. A little different stand, but we got that same thing in common. We could not really see what the real problem was. Alcoholism is hard to explain to people. Supreme Court of the United States has now decided, I guess, that it may not be a disease. It took 50 years for the American, not 50, but took a long time for the American Medical Society to decide it was, and now they're writing briefs to the Supreme Court with those gray-headed old men up there. They don't know for sure. Lots of lawyers don't know for sure. But anyway, how do you explain this thing? When I was out there on the farm, I had a dog. My dog's name was Patches. Patches was mostly a bulldog. Patches was a wonderful dog. He was just everything you ever wanted in a dog. He had no problems. He was well fed. He had no competition. Wasn't another dog on the place. He was a hero. About a week or so before this story I'm about to tell you, he was up in the field and we found an old badger that weighed 1 pound more than Patches did. I know he weighed a pound more than Patches because after Patches killed him after 2 or 3 hours of fighting, we weighed them both. Weighed a pound more than Patches. Just to give you a little insight into Patches' personality, Every day for a week after he got that old badger killed, he'd go up there in the field and pick him up and just shake hell out of him, just to let him know he's still boss. Now, the morning I'm going to tell you about, Patches was laying in our yard, no problems. Hero, well-loved, well-petted, everything you could have, everything you needed to be a dog. And into our yard came a big old boar hog from a neighbor's place. Ugly, ugly hog. Long yellow tusk. And for reasons that remain obscure, Patches decided to get hold of the hog. Now, when a bulldog makes that kind of decision, it's not a casual decision. I mean, they get into it. And he went out there and got hold of the hog. And it created a problem in our family. The hog was squealing. Patches was barking and growling. Dad heard the noise. He came running out there. He ran out there and began to cuss and kick hogs and dogs. I saw what was happening to my dog, and I got out there trying to save him from my dad and the hog both. Mother saw her little boy running out to this melee going on out there, and she came running out trying to save me. Everybody out there was in the middle of this damn problem. It was right there in your face. Everybody there knew the solution to that problem. Patches turned loose of the hog. Well, he didn't turn loose, but finally he got knocked off, and when he got knocked off, the old hog wheeled around and slashed his throat with one of those tusks. And we were able to catch him and hold him and stop him, drag him up under the water hydrant, run cold water on him, patch him up, slow him down, let him get control of himself, and turn him loose. Patches went right back and caught hold of the hog again. Same deal. Same deal. Squealing, barking, cussing, kicking, crying, everybody just having a hell of a problem out there. All of us knew the solution. Hog knew it, we knew it, everybody knew it. Patches turned loose of them all. He finally came off again, and this time we caught him. Now, we'd learned something. We knew that Patches wasn't himself. If there are psychologists in our midst, they would say his emotional nature had gone over the top of his intellect. And it's obvious that if he wasn't himself, we were going to have to do is take care of him, maybe against his will. So we committed him. We tied him to the water hydrant. We'll let him think about his life. Have you ever had a good time catching hold of hogs? Do hogs taste good? Do you ever get cut up by a hog? Does Jerry like for you to play with hogs like this? Does it cause all kinds of problems in your family life? Just let him really begin to get an in-depth look at himself here. Know what the problem was. And to help him out, we ran the hog off. Ran him off back down toward the neighbor's place. And I was given the job of watching Patches. I guess I was sort of his counselor. And I sat there and I petted him and I scratched his ears and I loved him and, you know, whatever you do. Mainly I watched him, let him slow down. I said, you could tell he was getting better. He was. He got that kind of grin dogs get on their face, you know. He's panting and he ain't growling and straining at the chain anymore. He's laying down and he's cool and his little old tail is about that long. It's beginning to wiggle a little bit and it's obvious after a couple hours that he has recovered. And so, we turned him loose. He had to go 2 miles to find the hog again, but he got him again. Does anybody here identify with that story? I'll tell you what, if you can't find yourself in one of those players in that little drama, you're in the wrong place, I'll tell you. We were the first chapter of Hogging On in West Texas, I guess. Well, that's what it's all about, isn't it? What's the problem? The first inquiry, what is the problem? Do you have a problem? What is it? Seemed like, in Patches' case, it was catching hold of hogs, didn't it? seemed like with me, it was drinking whiskey. Seemed like that was what was causing the chaos in our family. That's what everybody told me anyway. I mean, everybody had something to say about this in my house. You know, I'd be a better father, I'd be a better lawyer, I'd be a better this, that, or the other if I just didn't drink the way I did. If I would just moderate, if I just, you know, would be reasonable about this thing. That's the way it seemed to me. And I knew that wasn't a problem. Because I was drinking what I wanted to drink. I had always drank what I wanted to drink. It was no secret. I was an out front drunk. I became a little out front, less out front as time went along, because it got to look like it might, you know, cause me some trouble with my law license and with my partnership with my partners, and I gradually reduced the scope of my activities. My wife didn't like me hanging around on Saturday night or Friday night with the boys, and so she said she didn't want me to do that anymore, so I stayed home, but I kept on drinking. Wherever I was, I drank what I needed to drink. And it seemed like that was the dealing with that seemed to be what everybody thought the problem was. But you see, with old patches, turn loose the hog wasn't a real problem. The real problem was what sent him out there in the first place. What sent him back after he'd been burgered up pretty good? And what sent him back again? Turned out it wasn't hogs at all. Because about a month or so later, he caught a cattle truck. Just caught one of those. Don't know why he needed to get hold of a cattle truck. Nobody knew why I needed alcohol. But that was the deal. Twofold disease. The disease that has to do with the physical part. I don't give a damn what the Supreme Court says. When I drink whiskey, something starts in my body. Something starts, I don't know what it's biochemical, emotional, I don't have any earthly idea, don't even care. I just know that when it hits the bottom and spreads out, a signal sends to my brain, and my brain says, I believe we'll have another of those. And we keep having another one of those until we're in real bad shape. And I did that a long time, and I know that part of the deal is for sure. The other part, and this is where Alcoholics Anonymous starts. Our solution is to allow us to learn to live so we don't need to drink. The book of Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't give you a hint on how to stop drinking. It assumes that you've already stopped. It takes you up from that point right there. And it deals with the part of the problem that centers in our minds. It's called an obsession. An obsession for me is a real big thought. It's a thought that pushes all other thoughts out of my mind. When I think it, everything else goes away, and with me could be generally characterized as a drink would make it better. I don't care what it is, a drink would make it better. Wake, wedding, fancy ball, good times, bad times, whatever it happens to be, a drink would make it better. And I have to find a way not to take that first drink. I have to find a way to live and correct the way my mind works, or I'm going to wind up always drinking and always drinking more than I should, and one day I'll die or go insane or whatever happens to alcoholics. That's what the point was. In my case, I stayed on the deal for a long time. I had to look at this problem for a long time. My defense systems were such that I couldn't even imagine that I had a problem with alcohol. I knew I drank more than most people. I knew that for a long time. I didn't really know anyone else who was drinking as much as I was drinking. But it was because I wanted to drink that much. The day I decided I didn't want to drink that much, I quit. But I wanted to drink that much. Why? I don't know. Sometimes, a lot of times I wondered, why do you want to drink that much? But I did it. And I just didn't spend much time thinking about it. And it wasn't until my wife, after years of marriage, began to do funny things, that I began to get some kind of a clue of what was going on in my life. To get past the illusion that one day I could drink like a normal man. That one day I could, you know, I would level off. I was always going to level off. Just as I get this problem solved, I'm going to level off. She began to, we'd had a lot of trouble with drinking. She had a real psychological aversion to alcohol. We sent her to a psychiatrist for that for a while. And he agreed. She was, you know, she's screwed up about drinking. She really is. But after a while, he quit wanting to see her and started wanting to see me. So we dropped that. But along about 1971, I began to notice that she was doing some different things. And we were having a different kind of a marriage about that time also. So there was not a lot of communication in our relationship. When it was, we yelled at each other. I guess we both thought we were hard hearing or something because most of our conversations were loud. We decided we're about to give this damn marriage up. Both of us thought the other one was just making a mess of the whole deal. And one night I asked my daughter, or one afternoon, where's your mother? She said, I don't know, Daddy. She's gone to a meeting. I said, what kind of a meeting? She said, I don't know, Daddy, it's a family meeting. Now, we've been talking about divorce, and it seems to me like if we're going to have any family meetings, that probably I need representatives to be present at this kind of meeting. So when she came back in, I had my work cut out for me. My wife is one of the world's most elusive witnesses. I've spent years cross-examining that woman, trying to find out what I want to know, you know, and she can duck and dodge better than anybody I ever saw, and she was really good on this subject. Where have you been? Out. Out where? Oh, over to Preston Center. What were you doing there? Meeting with some friends. Who were they? You wouldn't know them. What did you talk about? Oh, we just shared our experience, strength, and hope. And we went on and on and on, ducking and dodging, and finally I got it pinned down, and I got a word out of her. She had been to an Al-Anon meeting. Al-Anon. Al-Anon. What is an Al-Anon? I thought it was probably an aluminum kitchen utensil or something like that. I asked her a few more questions, and she said that it had something to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. And a few more questions, and I found out that anyone can go to an Al-Anon meeting. Everyone is welcome. If you know an alcoholic, if you have a friend who's an alcoholic, you're welcome to come to the public meetings and talk about the drunk in your life. My God. Here I am. I'm, by this time, the only thing I've got that's worth anything in the world is my standing as a lawyer in the community. I'm a big-time lawyer. I think I am a big-time lawyer. I'm with a big law firm. I'm a senior partner in that big law firm. And we don't have any openings for alcoholic lawyers in my firm. I know that's true because we've already had a couple, and I've heard them talking about what we're going to do with them. And what we're going to do with them is get rid of them just as quick as we get their clients away from them. Only they had a lot of clients, and I didn't have very many. And it's just as obvious as the nose on your face that a bad thing is going to happen if my wife is going to public meetings. I've got lots of partners. They all got wives and family. We all know each other. They're judges that go out glad-handing and meeting the community. There are all kinds of state politics. There's all kinds of people who would go to one of those public meetings. Thousands, jurors, witnesses. My God, clients. The list is endless of people who might show up at one of those meetings, and the day they showed up and saw my wife there, I am immediately tried and convicted of being an alcoholic. Without a hearing, without anybody, not even knowing it's happening. And they'll go back and tell my partner. And when my partner's here, they'll call me in and they'll explain to me that they don't have any openings for alcoholic lawyers and I'll be kicked out. My clients will find out that they've got an alcoholic lawyer and nobody, not even drunks, want an alcoholic lawyer. They'll stay with the firm. I'm on the street. When that happens, the money stops. The house has got a mortgage on it. The car's got a mortgage on it. Everything has got a mortgage on it. If it's not paid, they take them away. And we're on the street. We ain't got any money. We haven't got any food. We're not talking about college education for the kids now. We're talking about bare survival. And your going to those public meetings is causing that to happen. Do you understand? I think I painted about as clear a word picture as you can paint of that situation. And I said, it's obvious. You must not go back. And she said, I'm going back. And I said, please, please don't go back. She said, I need to go back. And I said, I don't know. If you go back, I'll kill you. But they'd had her too long by that time. She'd been brainwashed. And she continued to go. And I never, from that moment on, I never had a moment's peace. Every time I saw her, I wondered, had she been to one of those meetings? Who had she seen there? What was going on there? What had she told them about me? Had she told them about the fights we were having? Yeah, I got a little angry sometimes. Yeah, maybe you'd call it a little abusive sometimes. But nothing serious. I mean, hell, I was provoked, wasn't I? There's two sides to this story, and they're going to only hear one. I know that. And I couldn't leave her alone. I couldn't leave her alone. She didn't do things to be left alone very good either. She kept doing other things to remind me of it. Her sponsor told her, you're supposed to live one day at a time. And the way you're supposed to start each day is the moment, just the moment you wake up, say out loud in a joyful voice, this is the day the Lord has made, I shall rejoice and be glad in it. Now, if you have never had a quart of whiskey, and the night before, and are laying there with one eye stuck shut, a mouth that you can strike a match in, you know, dry, your head just going boom, boom, and you hear somebody say that, you're pretty sure you're not going to do a lot of rejoicing today. It ain't going to be too joyful a day for me. She was doing it, writing things. There was literature about alcoholics all over the damn house. And we were constantly at it. We fought about this. God, we really hooked up on this. She seemed to be getting happier. One night I made a mistake that no good trial lawyer ever really makes. I asked a question when I didn't have a deuce's idea what the answer was. How it happened was I decided I would pick a fight. And the way I pick fights is I start off trying to get the facts I'm going to need to win the fight admitted by the other side. And I started it real easy that night. I said, Billy, you think I'm an alcoholic. She said, I don't know whether you are or not. I said, well, that's damn funny. You've called me an alcoholic for years. She said, yes, I have. But I was wrong. It's really hard to get something going with a lady when she's doing that, I'll tell you. She said, it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what I think. It matters what you think. If you don't think you're an alcoholic, then you're not in any position to have recovery. You've got to decide for yourself whether you're an alcoholic. And then I asked the dumb question. I said, if I wanted to find out if I was an alcoholic, how would I do it? If Oh, my friends, they got an answer, let me tell you. She said, well, you should try some controlled drinking. She said, I said, what do you mean, controlled drinking? She said, you ought to drink 2 drinks a day. Every day for 6 months. Don't skip any days, never drink more than 2 drinks. If you can do that for 6 months, you're not an alcoholic. I said, do I understand that you, who have been trying to get me to stop drinking for years and years, now want me to drink an additional 6 months? She said she did. And I realized that I was dealing with a woman who was not herself. And that I better get the hell out of there because things were happening that I did not understand. And I went away and sat in my green chair and mixed myself some drinks and began to give this a good thing. Matter of fact, I thought it over pretty good for a couple of weeks. And in sheer desperation, I finally recognized that somebody was going to have to sacrifice to save our family. She obviously was going to continue to go to those public meetings unless I could convince her through taking that damn test that I was not an alcoholic. So, I decided I will take the test. I didn't tell her I'm going to take the test. I decided I'd let her find that out for herself. She had noticed, she counted, she knew what I was doing all the time. So, started taking the test. Well, I had to change the test a little bit. Well, you don't understand. 2 drinks don't do me any good. 3 drinks. I've been drinking about a quart a day. Now I'm going to cut back to 3 drinks. And I got a big size, good size glass. And I'm going to have 2 big glasses of gin before dinner. I call them martinis. And then I'm going to have dinner. And then I'm going to have 1 big brandy after dinner. That's the way gentlemen drink. Nobody could fuss at you for drinking that way, could they? And they wouldn't have. But you see, I had a part of my awakening was to determine that I didn't have alcohol. Alcohol had me. And the way I discovered that was incredible to me. I would start my 3-drink deal, and I'd have my martinis. Near the end of the martini, I would say, well, that's about all the martinis today. And then it would happen. A thought would come wandering in from out of left field. It would say, what are you doing? What are you doing? Are you over 21? Are you a man? Who supports this damn family around here that's criticizing you all the time? Who brings the money in here? Are you going to let a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes tell you how to drink whiskey? And the answer was always, hell no. And I got up the bar and drank what I damn well pleased, which was the bottle. And I'm gone again. That didn't happen every day. Some days I'd go to the bar and I'd get to the bar and I'd decide, to hell with it, I've had a bad day, I'm just not going to take that damn test today. That day I drank the bottle. Then I had a really strange thing happen. I spent a lot of time thinking about this. But I could forget to take the test for 2 weeks at a time. Every day I forgot it, I drank the bottle. And then I'd wake up that one morning, or whatever it was, when I remembered again, and it all dropped back in on me again. What the hell's wrong with you? You blew it again. Here I am, a person who's been reasonably successful in life. I've achieved at this point in my life more than I ever thought I would. I had more position, more prestige, more money, more of everything that they tell you on the television shows that makes you happy than I'd ever thought I could have. And here I am, I can't decide that I'm going to have 3 drinks and stick with it. What's wrong with a person who can't do that? Why can't you do that? It's illogical for a grown man not to be able to do that. And I decided, well, by God, today I'll do it. Only the same thing would happen again. Now, I didn't give this test any little short run. I ran her about a year and a half. I don't think I ever passed it once. I don't ever remember passing it. Whether I passed it or not, over the long haul, it became obvious to me that when I put alcohol in my system, when I took one drink, something happened to me. I didn't understand what was wrong. I thought I'd lost all my willpower, all my moral fiber. My self-esteem just dropped to the bottom. All I could think about was drinking. Wishing I didn't drink. Wishing I had another drink. I even began to sneak drinks after all those years of flaunting them, you know. As though Billy knew I was trying to pass that test, but nobody in the world knew I was even taking the damn test, let alone flunking it, except me. I was raised to be afraid of snakes because my folks didn't know. I couldn't tell the difference between a rattlesnake and a bull snake out in West Texas. We had both, so they taught me to be afraid of all of them. And that carried forward. They convinced me, and I have a deep conviction today, that snakes are likely to bite you if they get a chance. They're just nasty customers. Not only that, but they hide. You can't see the damn things. They never give you any warning until you're right on top of them. And then it's almost too late. And they hide in that tall grass, and you're barefooted, and you're going to have to walk through that tall grass. You anticipate there's going to be a snake there. You're stepping high. You're ready to go. Scared snakes. Then I found I was afraid of everything. Afraid of failure. Oh, my gosh. I say I like to win. That's not so much true. I can't tell you very many cases I've won. I've tried lots of lawsuits. But I can tell you every one I lost. I can tell you the name of the plaintiff's lawyer. I can tell you the name of the plaintiffs, who the witnesses were, what court it was in, and how they got to me, by God. That's, you know, what I should have done. I know what I should have done. I live with fear. And I had to take this inventory and find about these thoughts, these negative thoughts. What your thoughts, you have to watch your thoughts because they become your actions. Your actions become your habits. Your habits become your character, and your character becomes your destiny. And we start back at ground zero in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we get back and we look at those things. And we have to tell somebody about those things. It's not good enough to know it yourself. You have to talk about it. You can no longer live alone. To be in a spiritually awakened existence, you can't have those kind of secrets about yourself. Not everybody in the world has to know them, but you can't have any secrets. You've got to be free to be yourself. See, I wasn't free to be myself. I wanted to be what I thought you wanted me to be. And I carried this facade around. I thought I had to be a man. And what I defined a man to be was a person who had no feelings, who had no fear, who would fight, who would do all these things, who was brutal at times. I had those ideas about being a man. And I had to recognize that that wasn't me. I never was that kind of person. I never one day was that kind of person, but I'd put that kind of front up. I've been so successful at it, the partners in my law firm call me the alligator gar. I was proud of that. Can you imagine that? How anybody would be proud of that kind of a reputation? All mouth and teeth. And that's what I wanted to be. And I had to get ready to be rid of that. I had to give that up, and I had to get involved in a new way of life. I don't know the day it happens, but if you're really lucky, it'll happen to you. You'll find that one day you went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you didn't need to go. You'll suddenly realize, I wasn't going to take a drink today. Why in the world did I go to that meeting? Could have watched television, could have gone to a movie. I'll tell you why you went to the meeting. I'll tell you why I went to the meetings. I went there because I liked what was happening there. I began to see people, some of them I even got to 12 step, come to the meeting. Some of them got sober. People that you knew damn well, you're just wasting your time bringing them in there because they're obviously gone. They don't have enough sense. They can't even make complete sentences, some of them. And if you knew they were going to get sober, you damn sure took a picture of them in the beginning so you could show before and after. But in a couple of weeks, they clean up. In a month, they begin to talk sensibly. Then you begin to find out some things about them, and they're really marvelous people. Right there in front of your eyes, you have seen it happen. And you know inside yourself that you played some small part in making that happen. You were a bike rider for a little while. And if you ever have that happen to you, we got you. You really are hooked. I had to find about self-centeredness. That's the core of all these negative feelings. I had to find self-centeredness in my life and look for it the rest of my life. I didn't find it in any great big things, but I found it in my past. I found it in traffic. We have freeways in Dallas, and I don't know about y'all, but I own one lane of traffic. It's called my lane. And what goes on in my lane is my business. And nothing happens in my lane that is not directed to me. If you get in front of me, you slow me down, you've done that on purpose. And it's my God-given duty to punish you. If you run up behind me and honk, I will drive 5 miles an hour to make you know that that's not the thing to do in my lane of traffic. I began to see these things. I learned about them because you all told me about your self-centeredness, about how you took everything personally. And one night in a meeting, I was sitting there, and I had another problem with manageability. I thought I managed pretty damn well. I look at all my successes. I could show you all my plaques and things, you know. I thought I managed pretty well. And they talked about unmanageability, and they talked about self-centeredness, and I had trouble identifying with that. And then one night in a meeting, I remembered my fishbowl. In the midst of my drinking, I had gotten tired of watching television. I was even, you know, I was smarter than I am today. I watch it on television now, but I shouldn't. It's terrible stuff. And I decided I'd get me a fishbowl, an aquarium. And I got the size aquarium I wanted, and I put it between my chair and the wall, so nobody else would screw around with it. And I put the kind of gravel in the bottom that I wanted, and I put the kind of plants in there that I wanted. I like those lacy, fern-like plants. And I put the kind of fish I wanted in there. The kind of fish that I like are pretty, slow-swimming fish. I like to watch them just go down, float up at the top and get a little nibble, you know, and sail back down to the bottom. Just love to watch those pretty, slow-swimming fish. I put a light on my tank. I could make it daylight or I could make it dark, just as I chose. I fed my fish if they were to be fed. Sometimes it was a land of plenty, and sometimes there was a famine upon the land. In this meeting that night, I remembered that there was always one damn fish. Usually a bowl cleaner or some utilitarian, ugly kind of fish that you kind of need to have in there, who would inevitably, right in the middle of my watching the British graceful fish swim around, begin to chase one of them and bite them on the tail, which would make them swim faster, and they begin to pass other fish who began to swim faster, and the first thing you know, the whole damn bowl was just going back and forth like that. Just drove me insane. And I'd reach over there and I'd swat the side of that bowl. Bluey! Let them know there's a power greater than they are outside that bowl. And he is displeased. Then I gave him three chances. I gave him three claps of thunder. You'd think they'd learn, wouldn't you? Somebody's going to like me chasing these fish. I ought to quit. Then some of them don't learn. So I bought me a little dip net. And I would catch the bad fish after he'd had three claps of thunder to give him a little more hands-on experience with the power. I fished him out and I held him in my lap. And I had a drink. I let him think about what he'd been doing wrong while I thought about the people out there in the world that I'd like to get my dip net on. Then I put him back. Timing is really important here. You can tell if you kept them out too long, because if you kept them out too long, they float. And if they float, there doesn't seem to be any way back for them. But I was pretty good on my timing. Most of the time I got them back in there. And once again, I practiced the mystical rule of three. I gave them three hands-on experiences. Now, you'd know they'd learn, wouldn't you? Well, there are such unfortunates that seem to have been born that way. And the last time I hauled them out, I looked neither left or right. I just went in the commode and flushed them. Not a soul in the world knew that this 41-year-old man was playing this kind of game with fish. Most people of that age are not real concerned about what fish do or don't do. Most people don't get personally offended when a fish chases another fish, which is what I do. Damn few people try to discipline them. There will be somebody here tonight who will come up and tell me they did something like this with fish. I hardly ever told this story that somebody doesn't come and tell me about them. We are fish trainers along with something else. Something is important here. But I had to find this thing. Now, as I found self-centeredness, and as I told people about it, and as I began to try to be of service and to work with new drunks and help other people and to make amends, remarkable things began to happen in my life. Changes came over me. They were so profound that people could see, visibly see the changes. I was stopped in a fishing tackle store up in Colorado one summer on vacation, and I saw a man across the room that I knew from Dallas, and I started to walk towards him, and he got this funny look on his face that they get, you know, when they're trying to remember who you are or something. And he said, "Aren't you Jerry Jones?" And I said, "Well, hell yes, Bill. We've been on the board of the church. We've gone deer hunting together. We've done lots of things. We were in Sunday school class for years." I said, "Yeah, I'm Jerry Jones." He said, "What happened to you?" I said, "Oh, I've got a few more dents and a little more gray hair, but, you know, I'm about the same." He said, "Oh, no. No," he said, "you're not angry anymore. You're not angry anymore." You know how many days I had worked on anger in that 3 years that I'd been sober? None. I'd been doing something else, and anger had gone away. Do you know how much I worked on not wanting a drink of whiskey? None. Just one day, as the book said, I remembered that I hadn't wanted one for a while. I used to know every time I could drive through a town at 60 miles an hour and tell you how many liquor stores we passed and where they were located when I went out the other side of town. And I quit noticing liquor stores one day. I don't know when that happened, but a change came over me. I got a new sense of values, and I began to act and live inside my values. I began to be me, doing what I thought was the right thing to do. That's the most freeing thing that you can imagine doing. That is really all we're ever going to be, and all you can ever do. Now, I'm not always right. Sometimes when I've acted what I think, done what I think is the right thing, it turns out to be the wrong thing. And I have to make amends, just like I had to make amends to a lot of people in my family, in my friendships, in my law partners, for the things I'd done while I was a drunk. I was universally accepted by those people. I remember the day I went to my partners to begin to tell them. That was the biggest fear I had. It was 11 months sober when I went to tell them that I had stopped drinking. They noticed. And I told the managing partner, I said, I'm So I'll tell you that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic, but I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not telling you that for any good reason or bad reason. I'm just telling it because you ought to know it. If you see me drinking, some of our clients are in trouble. If you know anybody that needs help, I might be able to help. And I figure he's going to find me right there. I figure he's going to say, well, real sorry to hear it. Hope you find another place to work. And he said, I'm delighted. When you tell me that you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're an alcoholic, that's something more than most people have your problem never can do. But we've known something was wrong with you. We've asked you about drinking, but you said that wasn't a problem. But I'm glad for you. And I walked out of that room, I could have whipped King Kong left-handed. I knew no fear. I was myself. From that point on, you can't take anything away from me. My whole life changed. My marriage with Billy went back to a really good marriage. Not immediately, and not always today, but it's a good marriage. It's a good relationship. We work the same program. We have the same values, the same standards. I have a son who's a doctor in the middle of medical school. He came home in bad trouble and began to go to adult children of alcoholics and then sneak into closed meetings of AA, and I told him he wasn't supposed to do that because that was for alcoholics. And then Dampy did come up and take a desire shift and join AA one night. He was able to talk to me about that. I was able to be an example of a solution that worked for him. My daughter calls me and asks me from time to time, what would AA do about this? My partnership is better today. My business is better. Everything in my life has been turned around. Let me tell you, the best, most graphic illustration of this awakening that I have in my life. It has to do with my mother, that little Irishman that taught me to ride bikes. I loved her so much. When she kept telling me I was doing the wrong thing with that drinking, and I kept doing what I damn well pleased, and she loved me with an open hand. There was always one place I could go, and that was home. And she got cancer before I got sober. Worried the hell out of me. They were going to do surgery, and they asked me to come up and be with her. Of course, I went. And I wasn't going to drink that trip because she didn't like drinking. She died with 75 years of continuous sobriety and didn't think it was any big deal. She went in the operating room that day, and I hadn't had a drink for a couple of days, and the doctor hadn't been gone long, and he came back out, and he said, oh, boy, she just... I told my dad and I said, it's just no good since she's got cancer everywhere. It's all over. And I turned around and all that resolve I had about not drinking, all the love I had for her couldn't stop me from going out that door. And I went directly to a liquor store. And I played like I was sober for 2 or 3 days, but I was drunk. And she knew it. She recovered from the surgery and she said she knew it later. Everybody knew it. They finally sent me home because I was of no use to anyone. After I'd been sober, the first thing I ever did, I guess the first amend I ever made was to my folks, I sent them a copy of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, this is the way I'm going to try to live my life. And they loved it. Dad would have bought AA if he could have. Every time they passed the hat, he went for his wallet, and I had to tell him that we're self-supporting, and he just couldn't understand why he couldn't give this thing a whole bunch of money. But I'd been sober for a while, and Mom and I got it all straightened out, and we thought she'd recovered from cancer. Chemotherapy seemed to work for her. And it'd been 11 years. And I got another call. I said, come up here. Looks like we found another lump. And I went back up there and talked to Mom for a while and the doctor, and Mother said, Jerry said, I want you to get the family in here. I said, I want to talk to them. So she brought them. Got them all in there, and she said, folks, she said, I don't know whether I'm going to make it this time or not. I've been fighting this stuff for 17 years. I said, I'm tired. I ain't quitting, but I'm tired, and I'm weak. And the next few weeks may be very, very hard on all of us. She said, Jerry here will be your strength. You can lean on him. And with that, they operated on her. It took 2 horrible weeks for her to die. It was a bad scene. My dad blew an ulcer in the middle of it and had to have most of his stomach removed. It was just a bad gig. but not one time, not 1 minute, not a second. Did he ever think about taking a drink? Same boy, same mother, same situation. Only one thing had been added. A spiritual awakening had occurred. And I knew that whatever's going on here can be lived with one day at a time with the program of alcoholics. I even came to know that it was time for my mother to die. And it was. She did. But with dignity, she showed me how to live and she showed me how to die. We've been given a great and beautiful gift here. We have the ability to stay close to the basics, to teach people how to have these spiritual awakenings. The room here is full of bike riders, but everybody's got to ride. Everybody's got to do their part, because there are thousands of people out there on the streets today who are in deep, deep trouble and have no solution. No one has a solution for them except the power that we find in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have been given much, and to those whom much is given, much is expected. And I commit to you that as long as I can, I will stay hooked. I'll keep the faith, and I believe you will too. Thanks so much.